The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit.
Well, the bank, headed up by our first guest this morning, has been making headlines this week with their technology troubles. It was a bad week for Bank of Ireland, with glitches and outages causing frustration for many, all in the lead up to payday and the biggest shopping day of the year, Black Friday. Francesca McDonough is the chief executive of the bank, from Croydon in South London originally. She took over as head of Bank of Ireland 2 years ago. Francesca, let's start where the week has ended. 2 days of outages at a time when the bank is trying to rebuild trust with customers. What happened?
Well, thanks, Sonia, for having me on the show. So this week we've had a couple of days that have created a lot of disruption for our customers. And I know that's particularly frustrating for customers because it's towards a month end. People are getting ready and doing Christmas shopping. And we had a period where some payments, but specifically on the Thursday, our online banking and many of our ATMs weren't working. We let down our customers and we've apologised. And we absolutely hate it when that happens. It creates a disruption that is unacceptable. And our focus was on fixing the problem, which we did on Thursday evening. No customer will be out of pocket as a result. And our focus is on putting everything right for any individuals that still may feel that they were impacted. But it shouldn't have happened. And for me, it validates the decision that we've made to transform our IT systems to make them better.
Is something like this likely to happen again?
Well, I very much hope not. We work very hard to meet our customers' needs whenever they need us, 24/7. On occasions, you'll see across the banking sector, there is sometimes a disruption to services, but we work incredibly hard to avoid that happening. Customers expect us to be always available. We get complaints, we impact our reputation, and it destroys trust when we get it wrong. So we work very hard to avoid this sort of event happening. And like I said, I hate it when it does.
And you mentioned trust there. And yeah, on a day like Wednesday and Thursday, where people can't access their monies, it's payday, it's mortgage repayments, people are massively inconvenienced. You'll have seen it trending across social channels. People are angry. And in moments like that, it's communications 101. You do regular updates, you show empathy. But Bank of Ireland went missing at times on Thursday in terms of the updates and the consistency of telling people what was amiss and what had gone wrong.
We were actually active on social media, responding to customers' individual concerns, but also giving updates. And a senior member of my team who heads up our Retail Ireland business was actually on the radio on Friday morning to explain what had happened and confirm that everything was back in order. So obviously, we would be doing everything we can through our branches, through our contact centres and through social media to be in constant contact with our customers, which if you look at our sort of Twitter feed, we were.
You mentioned an IT upgrade there, reported originally to cost 900 million, now 1.4 billion. Is that part of the problem? Like, where are you at in terms of that digital transformation, that big switchover?
Okay, so I've been the CEO at Bank of Ireland for just over 2 years, and about 18 months ago, we set out our multi-year strategy, and that included the transformation of the bank. And when I talk about transformation, I mean our cultural transformation, our systems and IT transformation, and also our business model. And the budget that we would have set 18 months ago was 1.4 billion euros over a number of years. We are absolutely on track. We've not spent a penny more, as we've indicated in our
results. And on track in terms of timeline or on track in terms of budget, or both?
In track in terms of budget, but also we've been making important changes and improvements, notwithstanding the events of this week. But IT transformation is difficult. I often compare it to sort of open heart surgery. It's not something you elect to do. It's a difficult thing, but we are a bank with, you know, a rich history and heritage of 236 years. And unfortunately, in recent years, we didn't invest in our technology. And that is what we are fixing now.
How does it affect staff morale this week when there is that 48 hours of intensity?
OK, so we have embarked on cultural transformation. And I can imagine some of your listeners' eyes rolling about what does that mean? So culture in a bank is really felt by everyone who works within it, but also customers and any stakeholders who engage with us. So the culture of a shop or the culture of a restaurant, you will feel when you walk in. You can see how, you know, the level of engagement and the sort of culture. If it's good, you notice it as a consumer, and if it's bad, you can notice it. Our staff never like letting our customers down, of course. And people that work in our contact centres or in our branches that are dealing every day with customers will feel frustration on the occasion when our systems don't work.
And as part of that cultural transformation, are you preparing your staff for a day when there will be fewer branches, less face time with customers and fewer staff? So how do you game that out? Can you only get to that point of thinking about redundancies and less staff when you have the tech piece in play?
That's not the sort of dialogue or conversations that we're having, and let me explain why. So we have the largest branch network of any bank in Ireland. We have over 250 branches. We've actually opened more branches than we've closed in recent years. And despite the increased use of technology and digital ways of banking, customers will still use our branches, particularly in rural Ireland, where we'd be the leading supporter of the agricultural sector, and that's an important community hub for reaching out and engaging with our customers. I said in the past, and I'll say it again, there'll be there's fewer people working today in banking, in the Bank of Ireland, than there were in the past. And that's the same for any European bank, because there's more automation. And in the future, there will be fewer. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we're talking about redundancies or job reductions. We've actually recruited over 1,000 people last year. We've promoted 1,000 people and developed them as part of their careers. Okay. So a lot of the reduction in headcount has actually been in head office and more senior management roles. I am not going to rush any technology change. And we've seen that can create more problems than it can solve. We want to make sure that what we're offering to our customers is ready and good.
So you say branches won't close. They will have more limited services, though. So paint me a picture of what a branch in a local rural town in Ireland might look like and feel like in 3 to 5 years. Will it be one person there and that's it? Everything else will be automated in that physical branch.
So it's a really interesting question, because when I arrived, I was quite struck. We had all these branches, but they were under-resourced and they had very limited services. So in the last 2 years, we've put 200 people back into the front line, into branches, and we've increased the cash services in many of their branches when they were restricted. So we've actually gone in the direction of having more people and more services in our branches. Now, we will go where our customers want us to engage with them. And behaviours are changing. And increasingly, customers want a much more digital engagement, hence the investment that we have been making. But the role of the branches is an important part of our business model. Are there some branches where there's more to do? Of course. And we're always challenging ourselves to increase our levels of service. But we've been very responsive to feedback that services and branches were too limited and the number of people was too low, and that has been addressed.
So when you arrived to Bank of Ireland 2 years ago, you inherited this massive tech transformation programme, but also the controversy around tracker mortgages. You took a different approach to your predecessor. What was the thinking behind that?
So you're right, actually. I arrived in the role and in Ireland in October 2017. I knew Ireland from family links. My father's of Irish origin, but it's not until I arrived in Ireland. I knew about the history of banking and the financial crisis, but coming into Ireland as the tracker issue really unfolded, it wasn't the sort of start that I would have hoped for in the bank. And I was called in, as were all the CEOs of the main banks, by the Minister of Finance, and you know, really told that we need to address this. And I had been working with the board at that stage to see if we could take a more customer friendly, less sort of legalistic approach to addressing trackers. And that's what we did.
And what else was a factor and a driver when you decided 2 years to take on this job? Was it legacy in terms of fixing the tracker mortgage scandal? Was it, for some people, it can be flexibility and security. You have a handsome salary, I think, in the region of 950 grand. Was it about alignment, sense of belonging? Like, what were some of those drivers 2 years ago?
Okay, so personal and professional. On the personal side, my father's father was from Galway. My grandmother was from County Laois. They moved as immigrants to the UK. The Irish link and family links were very strong. And there's an element of wanting to live and work in Ireland. Professionally, I'd worked for 21 years in an international bank that had taken me all over the world. And I had a I had great professional experiences. But I also, you get to a point, if you work in one company for 21 years, you make a decision, shall I stay for the rest of my career in the same institution or shall I move? And as I was having that thought, I got a phone call to ask if I'd like to be considered or think about the opportunity to be the CEO of Bank of Ireland. And I had an opportunity to meet some of the members of the board, and they talked about the history and heritage, but also the need for change. And that's a unique opportunity. And I was absolutely delighted, notwithstanding some of the challenges that we face, but delighted to take up that opportunity. And I feel very privileged to do the job that I do.
And what was the family history? What did they do when they moved to the United Kingdom?
So my I actually looked at some of the found some of the papers of my grandfather when he got married to my grandmother in around 1946. And the job that he had got to come to the UK to Surbiton to do was to repair roofs, tiles that had been damaged in World War II. And my grandmother came to the, when she came to the UK, she worked as a cleaner in Surbiton, and my father was a police officer, as was my mother, who was a refugee to the UK from Egypt in 1956 during the Suez Canal crisis. She was about 15. She came with my grandparents. And they would have had a pretty tough start coming into the UK. They would have, the first year, they were in an air hangar shelter, actually, in Bradford, where a lot of people that had fled Egypt at that point in time were housed. And my grandfather was a very good linguist, so he could speak many languages. And he was one of the first people who arrived in the UK in that cohort to get a job. And he got a job on the manual telephone exchange at British Telecom, when it was the original manual operator doing the sort of the wires between international calls. And he did that, and they moved from Bradford, from Yorkshire, to Croydon. And we actually, when my parents got married, and they met when they were both police officers, they got married and they started a family, and we lived next door to my grandparents, which was a really important part of my childhood growing up.
So interesting family background. You went to school in Croydon and then went to Oxford University, and there you studied philosophy, politics, economics. Was there anything in those family beginnings and background, your studies in Oxford, that would have prepared you for life then in the banking sector? How did that come about?
So I went, going to a local state school, you don't necessarily naturally aspire to go to Oxford. And none of my, I mean, I was part of the first generation of people in my family to start going to university. And I'd never actually been to Oxford, but for whatever reason, I just put my heart on, you know, what I thought was the best university for the course that I wanted to study. What was interesting is when I applied, you know, I thought I'd done a really good application, and I got a letter through some time later rejecting me from Oxford University. And I remember that feeling when you get, we all get those letters of rejection at times in our lives, the feeling of just such a disappointment. I called, when you apply to Oxford, you apply to sort of colleges within Oxford, so you apply to three. And I called each of them to say, I think there's been an error. I really think that you want to give me a position, a place. And the first two colleges said there'd be no mistake. And they gave me the reasons why I didn't have, you know, that didn't come from, you know, didn't have the right courses at my school, or I had been ill-advised about the criteria, etc. But the third college said, why do you think we made a mistake? And I tried to explain. And they said, why don't you come to Oxford tomorrow and tell us? So I literally bunked off school the next day, and I made my way to Oxford on my own to convince them why I should come. And it worked, and they made me an offer conditional against getting certain grades, and I worked really hard to get them. And I, by no stretch was I the brightest girl at school, but I really worked hard because I wanted that. And the reason why I put so much emphasis in is when you're the child of an immigrant and refugee who didn't have the opportunities of secondary or tertiary education, there's a lot of emphasis on education. And that, you know, my mother would always say to me, you can lose many things in life. You can lose your looks, you can lose money, you can lose love, and you can even lose your job, but you'll never lose your education. So there was a lot of emphasis on working hard to get the best education available. And I was lucky that I got into Oxford.
So take me back to that moment of trying to persuade Oxford University, you've made a mistake here. Who would have counselled you? What did you say to persuade them?
Well, no one necessarily counseled me. My school didn't know where I was actually on that day, but I thought it was in the spirit of sort of academic achievement, so I didn't feel too bad about not going in that day. And I was, you know, at that stage, I would have been, 17, 18. I thought, this is my opportunity. Just sheer kind of grit and hard work and determination, maybe. It wasn't through some sort of amazingly sophisticated academic argument.
Can you remember what you said in the room?
Yeah, I said that I wanted to learn. I'd worked really hard. How hard I'd come to get to that position. My passion for politics and economics in particular. And yeah, the desire to add diversity. Well, I didn't use diversity then, but as someone who came from a background where I was always going to be a little bit of an outsider at Oxford. I mean, there wasn't a huge alumni of Croydon girls who went to state schools. And I thought I could add a little bit of variety to that environment.
You mentioned the word outsider there. You then came to Ireland 2 years ago. You were the first female CEO of Bank of Ireland, the second, I think, so-called outsider to lead the bank in 200 odd years. What has that been like going from Croydon, Oxford, HSBC, like one of the biggest banks in the world, to a big player in a smaller bank and being its first female leader?
Well, overall, it's been a positive experience because the bank and Ireland has been very welcoming and kind to me. And So yeah, there are challenges and there are things that we need to improve and there's trust to be restored in the sector. But I'm very happy with the move that I made. I enjoy living in Ireland. I think Ireland is a fantastic country that has confidence, openness and positivity in a way that maybe the UK that I left 2 and a bit years ago didn't have. And it's Ireland is an outward looking country. And I feel very privileged to be in a role where I can really make a positive contribution.
Would you ever move back to the UK?
It's not necessarily within my plans. I'm never say never about anything, actually. I'm living here. Home is here. I have no plans to return to the UK.
You've been part of initiatives to try and drive 50-50 parity at the senior echelons of institutions in banking. How do we compare to the United Kingdom when it comes to that effort to drive more equity amongst women, men at highest levels of management?
So I'm a big believer of diversity and inclusion. Often as a woman, people think I just talk about gender. For me, it's all the full range of what is important and the benefits of diversity and inclusion. Diverse and inclusive teams make better decisions. They attract and enable more talent. And it's a big part of what I believe as a leader. We've made a commitment to have 50-50 appointments for all senior roles by 2021. Today we're at 42% female, 58% male. It's a challenge because we even though at the entry point we are 50-50, male-female, there are certain stages in people's career where that number begins to change and we're challenging ourselves on changing that so that people, women in particular, see a career, a long-term career in banking. And I think you can't be what you can't see. And if I'm a symbol of what's possible as a female, then great.
Have you been that single woman in a boardroom of men and what has that felt like?
Well, I think for anyone, whether you're the single man in a room of females or whether you're the only female, you feel like a bit of an outsider sometimes. It still happens. I mean, all male meetings. That can happen when I'm after meeting with investment banks or with investors. I don't really notice it so much anymore. I'm much more confident in my own reasons for being there. At earlier stages of my career, when you are the only person of your type in a room repetitively for hours and it's difficult, sometimes you might think maybe this isn't for me. Maybe this is a system telling me that I don't belong. Fighting through that and rejoicing being an outsider or in a minority is something that I found very empowering. And I've tried to change things so that other women or minorities don't feel that way. And addressing it and talking about it. A lot of the sort of symbols of power are very, very male and patriarchal. And we're trying to make changes in Bank of Ireland just to modernise the way we do things, the way meetings are held, office structures, dress codes, just to make it a little bit more real life.
Your world is one of tech outages, tracker mortgages, trying to put that right. I imagine repossessions, debts, thinking about future of work. It must be incredibly stressful. Like, what gives you joy? What gives you a sense of purpose in all of that?
Sometimes it's difficult, but it's difficult for a lot of people. I look at my father growing up as a police officer that wasn't being paid the money that I'm being paid and my mother as well. And they would have had stress and challenges as well. So I don't think I'm unique in having that. And nobody wants to work for a stressed out boss. I mean, that's not good leadership. So I try and keep that in check. and I have, you know, enough people that I trust around me to tell me if I'm getting it wrong, and I respond to that feedback.
You're on a reported salary of 950,000. Does that ever feel obscene to you? How do you justify that to yourself, to your staff, to your customers?
So my salary is set by the board. It's the same salary that my predecessor had. I'm totally aware it's a lot of money. And just to put that into context, I sort of learned that lesson a long time ago. So the very first year I worked in banking, I got a bonus. And that bonus was greater than the lump sum my father had got after 30 years of service in the police force, where he was, you know, endangering life and limb. And that was a reality check about how society rewards and pays certain professions more than others.
Does it feel, though, obscene there when you make those comparisons, when you're so acutely aware of customers and all of the difficulties they're going through?
I totally get that. There are certain, the reality is, and I know this is not a popular view, the reality is there are certain roles in technology, in finance and in risk where, because of supply and demand, where these are specialist roles, so the supply is low and the demand is high from non-Irish banks that are operating in Ireland or internationally, that the salaries for some of those specialist roles, which are important for a healthy and well-functioning bank, the salaries are at a level that the Irish banks are not able to meet. And that results in a problem for me, because money isn't the only reason that people choose to work in a bank. But if you consistently underpay people versus what they can find externally, they will leave. And, you know, part of my job is creating a healthy and sustainable bank, including technology, including risk. And I want to attract and retain and develop the best people. And I have some fantastic colleagues in the bank. But the restrictions for Irish banks do create a competitive advantage. And that's a challenge that we are having to operate within.
A lot of people are trying to get further up the ladder, particularly first-time buyers. Do you think that the rules, regulations coming from central bank are too strict? How are they playing out?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, over time, they may change. I'm not going to send a message that they ought to change now. I think that they are appropriate for the environment that we're in at the moment, and we operate within those rules.
But how then do you achieve, I think you've got an ambitious target of something like increasing your loan book by 20% by 21. Mm. That's very ambitious. Is that even acceptable in the climate, given everything this country has gone through? Is it advisable?
So we, absolutely it is. We've been, the Irish economy, the GDP is positive, it's growing. The UK economy, despite the challenges, is still in positive territory. A lot has changed since the financial crisis in terms of rules, risks, awareness, measurements. And we want to support the growth of the Irish economy, which is where most of our business is. And we have been growing. We would have reported a 1.2 billion euro net increase in lending in our latest results. And we continue on a growth trajectory. I think that's the right thing to do to support a growing economy.
Do you ever find yourself applying philosophy from Oxford University to day-to-day banking?
No, to be honest. Is a short answer to that, no. I think university was a while ago. I thought, to be honest, sometimes you don't actually remember what I learned at university, but what I remember is how I learned and the skills of consideration, analysis, you know, seeing two sides of the argument stand me in good stead every day. But no, I'm not quoting philosophy in meetings in the bank.
Francesca McDonough, CEO of Bank of Ireland, thank you.
Thank you.